In 2022, for the 30-year anniversary of the 1992 civil unrest, MHD engaged in a conversation with community organizer Leslie Cooper Johnson and former LAPD officer Brian Bentley to explore the history of policing in Los Angeles and discuss new models of public safety. As we reach the 32-year mark, we've decided to revisit this insightful and informative episode. And after the discussion, stay tuned for our Sit Down with a Staffer segment, where Renalee Garcia, CD8 Director of Constituent Services and Community Engagement, discusses her childhood experiences during the uprising and how CD8 is addressing its lingering effects. You're listening to MHD Off the Record. On this episode, we're speaking about new models of policing and public safety with two special guests, Brian S. Bentley and Leslie Cooper Johnson. Brian S. Bentley is a former LAPD officer and author of the book, One Time, The Story of a South Central Los Angeles Police Officer, where he graphically depicts his involvement in suspect beatings and describes in detail the gratification he and his partners received from their actions. We also have Leslie Cooper Johnson. She is the Vice President of Organizational Development at the Community Coalition and is currently the convener for the Push LA Collective, which stands for Promoting Unity, Safety, and Health in Los Angeles. Push LA was formed in response to decades of racist policing and has a mission to reimagine, protect, and serve. Enjoy the show.
All right. Welcome, everybody. We got great guests today. Siobhan, you've read the intros onto the podcast here. So I'll just get started because it's such an important topic. We're at the 30th anniversary of the 1992 civil unrest. It's been 31 years since we all watched the video beating of Rodney King on the side of the road in Los Angeles by Los Angeles Police Department officials. Or officers, and the struggle for reforming the relationship between the police and the community has come a long, long way, and both of you are part of that in different ways. And so I'll begin with you, Leslie. I know you're the Vice President of Community Coalition, longtime South LA resident and community leader, but kind of talk to us about how you got to the point that you are and how you came to sort of the leadership of the Push LA Coalition.
Well, first of all, I just want to say thanks for having me here. It's an awesome opportunity. I was excited about it. How did I get here? So I've been at Community Coalition for 15 years, and I've been working in South LA for that long. I came to the coalition through an internship. I was doing my master's in social work at the University of Southern California and took an internship opportunity at COCO. And it was my first introduction to community organizing, and it just made a lot of sense to me. It just, being at Community Coalition gave me the language and the framework of activism that I hadn't been able to express on my own before then. So I've really enjoyed being able to, you know, be a paid activist, if you will, and be able to, you know, have that be my livelihood and be able to fight for my community. I'm really excited about being able to do the Push LA work because police violence, police brutality has unfortunately been a part of my life and I think a part of the lives of many people who live in South LA. I actually live in Inglewood, but my church is in South LA, my work, everything. Yeah. And you know, we don't operate with the borders, like, you know, it's across the street, right? So, but I've had a lot of personal experiences. Unfortunately, a person that was very close to me was killed by the Inglewood police when I was a teenager and just saw, you know, black men mostly, my friends being pulled over, my friends being harassed. Not a lot of things happening to me directly, but to mostly to the men and the young men in my life. And so that's just been a part of my upbringing, a part of my life. And I feel very privileged now to be able to work towards, you know, changing some of those conditions around police violence and police abuse in our communities.
Excellent. And Officer Bentley.
Former officer.
You made that clear.
Please say that.
Yeah. Don't you get, once you have it, you have it. They're going to call me councilman forever, even when I finally get out of there. Okay. Tell us your story.
Well, I became a police officer in 1989, and I did my first probation, my rookie year, West Los Angeles Division. I had a black captain, and my training officer, my first day, told me that he wasn't there to train me. He was there to fire me because he believed that blacks, Hispanics, and women were only on the job for because of affirmative action. So I went to my captain and I complained and I said, hey, my training officer is racist. And my captain said, well, you know, I've been on the job 35 years. You don't think I know that already? He said that, you know, who do you want me to complain to? You want me to complain to the commander? He's a racist too. You want me to complain to Daryl Gates? He's also a racist. He said, you're just going to have to deal with it. And he said, if you're going to survive on this job, you're just going to have to deal with whatever comes along. He says, the racism, the police brutality, all that will be here. It was here before you came, and it's going to be here when you leave. That was his advice. He said, and if you want to have a long career, you just need to deal with it. Well, it always bothered me. And so at a, you know, at that beginning stage of my career, I knew that I couldn't go to the administration, to my superiors to complain about problems. I had to deal with them myself. And so one of the things I decided to do was to write books about everything that I saw that was incorrect for people who, you know, as a reference, for people who were activists who wanted to, you know, make a difference. So they would have resources and reference to try to go about, you know, make a change and understanding what it's like for a police officer and that whole mindset. And so that's why I started writing. And because of that, I got fired.
Wow. So you started in 1989. I presume you were there in 1991. It's just a year and a half later, I guess.
Yes.
When the Rodney King beatings happened. Walk us through that sort of year between March of 91 and April of 92 and I guess 94 even after that.
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles and I had friends who had been beaten by the police, and they would explain it. They would talk about it at school. And in my mind, I just thought it was just, you know, maybe like the police grabbed them or something like that. You know, I really didn't understand what it looked like. And so I was a rookie at West LA, and I was sitting in the watch commander's office getting a report approved, and I saw it on television, the Rodney King beating, and it was horrible. I just couldn't believe that, you know, that's what a police beating looked like, and it was just awful. Well, a couple months later, I transferred to Southwest Division, which is the division where I also live in, and on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being worst, the Rodney King beating was like a 3.
Wow.
Yeah, compared to what I saw in South LA.
Goodness.
It was like love taps. Almost every night, people were being brought into the station with brain matter coming out of their head, jaws broken, it was horrible. And so for me, seeing that all the time is something that I wanted to address. And my first book that I wrote, which is called One Time, what it does is it graphically depicts beatings and the psychological process that officers go through.
In fact, you say that officers are addicted to the violence.
Oh yeah, we officers, my partners, they live for that. Police officers consider themselves as hunters of men, and where's the best place to hunt is in the area where they don't complain and where you can just do whatever you want to do, and that's in South LA. You know, I had the opportunity to first start in West LA and then in South LA, and seeing that in West LA is totally different. I patrol Bel Air, Palisades. They don't treat people the same way as they do here. I mean, you have officers who literally come from Montana, Wyoming, and they all want to work 77th Division and Southwest Division, Newton Division, because they know that by reputation, those are the best places that are the most violent, the best places to hunt, where you can get into a shooting and it won't be questioned.
Wow. Leslie, I know Push LA has done a really good job publicizing a lot of the inequality in terms of traffic stops. And we focus on traffic stops because traffic stops are often the point of conflict, or where the conflict starts or where the beating happens. I mean, you know, this city has had two of the biggest civil unrest events in the history of the United States. Both of them started with a traffic stop. Talk to us about the data that you all have found and sort of the narrative that you're hearing in the community around the pretext, what's called a pretextual stop.
I will answer your question, but I'm still looking at, I know y'all can't see my face, but my face is, to hear that was a 3 on a scale to 10, because
that's crazy.
I mean, I was 13 years old when that video came out, and I remember looking at it and thinking, this is horrific. Just the way that they were kind of standing around him.
Yeah.
It just
yeah.
didn't even look like there was any kind of official business going on. Like, we're going to apprehend the suspect. It looked like someone was getting jumped into a gang. Like, there's just people
right.
surrounding
right.
him and just, you know, waiting to get their licks in. So to hear that was just a mild case is mild case. Mind-blowing to me. And I remember seeing that video and thinking, okay, finally someone's going to do something about this, because it's finally on video. And now the rest of the world will see what we've been living with and dealing with and talking about. And you haven't been listening because maybe you didn't know. Mm-hmm. But now you're going to see it for yourself and you're going to do something about it. And it was just so disappointing to see that that didn't happen. And it still doesn't happen. But to your question around PushLA and the data around pretextual stops, you know, it's interesting because there's also, you know, a debate about public safety going on in the landscape right now. And, you know, one of the good things about being at Community Coalition is that we're connected to real everyday people. So it's not just a bunch of us sitting around with degrees and, you know, pontificating around like what the community needs and what the people need. You know, we actually talk to real people, and people are tired of being pulled over and harassed, you know, for things like a broken taillight or other kind of pieces that are not criminal in nature in terms of like a crime against a person. And so the data shows us that Black people in particular are disproportionately impacted by what's called a pretextual stop, where you pull over someone for like a minor violation and then use that as an opportunity to investigate a more serious crime or just ask some questions and, you know, do what you will. So not only are Black people disproportionately impacted by that, like pulled over more than our representation in the population, but the data also shows us that when white people are pulled over, there's contraband found more often when white people are pulled over. So not only is it disproportionate and it's racist, but it's not effective. Like, you're not actually even doing the job that you said that you're setting out to do.
Right.
So that's doubly frustrating. And if I'm the chief of police, I'm looking at that and saying, this is not a tactic that's helping me, you know, actually stop crime. So why do I continue to do this? What am I getting out of this? You know? So that's what we're seeing. And people are saying, you know, in some cases when people call 911, they do want someone to show up.
Yep.
Where they don't want someone to show up is when they're just going about their normal business and you're getting pulled over. I've heard from folks getting pulled over, you know, more than once in a day in different parts of the city. Right.
Yep.
And I can hear that from my husband, a Black man who's experienced those things. So that's the crux of the data that we're seeing.
Yeah. You can hear that from any of the three Black men who are members of the city council.
Yeah.
Who've been pulled over while they're on city council in their government cars. Mm-hmm. Myself, not excluded from that. Also, you know, I'll tell an anecdote from being a council member that speaks to the data that you just put out, Leslie. You know, I had a brother come to me and say, you know, he's the manager of a grocery store in my district in South LA, in the 8th district. But he lives in the Inland Empire. Mm. And he says, getting off the 110 freeway, you know, to drive through my place, it's like, I've been pulled over 4 times and had my car searched and the whole 9 yards. And he's like, that is horrible. He's like, but here's what makes it worse. He's like, my store will be getting robbed. Like, an actual crime will be happening. And I call the police and it takes hours for someone to get there. And so he's like, what? Like, if there's time for 4 dudes to stop me by the freeway 4 different times in the space of a year, why is it that we can't get anybody when there's an actual crime going on that we're saying, okay, this is when we need you, when something's happening. Brian, can you give us a picture into how that works, how the process of deciding how you all are deployed or how you were deployed when you were an officer?
Well, I'll tell you a quick story.
Responding to calls versus just random pullovers.
Okay. I'm going to tell you a very quick story, too. When I was a police officer in West Los Angeles, I would take a shortcut through Culver City to get home. And I would get pulled over by Culver City PD at least twice a month. And it got so bad that my watch commander had to call Culver City PD's watch commander and tell them that there's this Black police officer about to drive home. Mm-hmm. And he would have to warn them. So it's a widespread problem, you know, as we already know. But here's the thing, you know, I'm glad that someone's doing something about the pretext stops. But let me give you some of the mindset of what goes into it. When I was at Southwest Division, the watch commander had a clipboard in his office. And it had all the generic police reports, all the generic crime reports, suspect between 5'5", 6'5", driving a dark colored car, and that clipboard was filled with these police reports with general descriptions. So whenever we pulled over someone and they said they didn't fit the description, by the time we got to the police station, they fit a description on that clipboard.
One of them.
And so what's interesting that I like is that officers have to articulate on their camera why they are taking that stop further to search the vehicle. because what we would do is that we wouldn't tell them why they're being pulled over or why we're searching their car. We wouldn't find that out until after we got back to the police station and looked through the clipboard. We'd say, okay, so we pulled over Marquise. We didn't have a reason, but let me look. You look through there, you say, here's a report of a blackmail, bald, right?
Mm-hmm.
We got you. So that's the mindset. And I'm hoping that the way things have changed, that is going to make a difference. It will make a difference, but some of the more officers who are really sick and who are really addicted to it will find a way to get around it. But that is the mentality, and people often talk about training. That's how police officers train. We don't need more training. Police officers are, people think that police officers are these ignorant males who only have a GED, but
or when it comes, jocks.
Right. Yeah. But whatever. But when it comes to circumventing your civil rights, they're like brain surgeons. They can just pick it apart. They can work around it. Wow. And they practice it in roll call. And, you know, that's what you're up against. And so these officers train for it. And when they stop you, they know that they're going to find a reason to do it. And when I was a police officer also, we had a cheat sheet. And it had all the minor infractions, everything. Things you didn't even know were in the vehicle code.
Right.
Dirty license plate. The major thing is a tassel or something hanging from the rearview mirror. You know, I never let my kids put their graduation tassel or work
badge, no one does anything that anymore.
I actually got pulled over for that.
Really?
Yeah. I had my graduation tassel hanging on my, what's that, the rearview mirror?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was told that was the reason, it was impeding my view. And that was the reason.
Wow.
That, even though it's below the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's like
and I would you know, my kids always thought, you know, because I was a police officer, I was very strict. But those are the, you know, that's a real fear. You know?
And it's, you know, I appreciate you for saying that, because sometimes I get beat up on the city council because the council will, something will happen. It will be a legitimate nuisance. Right. The latest thing was homeless people stealing bikes, bringing them to encampments, fixing them and then selling them. Right. I don't have any doubt that some people's bikes are being stolen. But what the city council wants to do is anybody fixing a bicycle on public property that can't produce a receipt is subject to arrest.
Who keeps a receipt of a bicycle that they
Right.
bought?
And how many times does your bike break on the way to the park? I feel like I only fix my bike in the street. Like, I don't feel
right.
like if my bike was broken in the backyard, that
Doing
was
your monthly maintenance.
Right. Yeah. Like, that didn't happen. But it's like I was trying to explain to my colleagues. It's like, look, bro, like you passed these laws and it may or may not stop what you're trying to get at, which I don't have any argument that people don't want their bike stolen. Great. You shouldn't have that. That shouldn't happen to you. But, you know, I'd rather make it easy for people to put GPS chips in their bike than to give police another reason to interact and right. stop people and harass people. So now you're going to have children working on their bicycles getting questioned by LAPD officers over right. nonsense.
And they stop you anyway. I used to get stopped all the time in high school.
On your bike?
No, I was walking.
Wow.
Because I was in the USC program. And mm-hmm. so we would take our That's morning right. classes at USC. Then we would either get bused back to our home schools, which would either be Manual Arts High School or Fauché. Sometimes we didn't have a bus to take us back, or the bus was broken down, or it was too late and we had another program we had to get to on campus, and we would walk. We would get stopped and our backpacks searched almost every time that happened. And when you said something about it, they just ignored everything you said. You can't do that. They didn't care. They just kept doing it. And it was something that was so pervasive that the university had to give us special IDs.
Wow.
So the police could see that we weren't ditching, we weren't truant. And by the way, police will make students truant. People don't talk about that. They'll literally pick them up 10 minutes before the bell, drive them around, and then make them, and they say, oh, now you're truant. Happened to my brother. So, yeah. So they'll stop anybody for any reason. If you give them another excuse.
Right. That's, that's why we fight it. And I try to tell people, it's like, it's not that I don't care that your bike got stolen. It's that this is the reality for people.
Right. And with a pretext stop, it's a numbers game. If you pull over, I'm just going to randomly say 35 people, you'll find one person who has a gun or some kind of contraband, right? And it's the same in West Los Angeles, but they don't do it.
Right.
You know, and so officers believe that it's a numbers game. You pull over enough people, you'll find that gun.
Right.
You'll find the drugs or whatever. But it's not the same. in West Los Angeles.
And that's not how a free country is supposed to operate. I mean, you know, I always say, if you want to completely stop crime, you just put it every male 18 to 35 in the military, and you probably won't have any crime. I mean, you won't have any violent crime for sure. But that's not what we do. We have a free country, and so people are allowed to be in the streets, to be in the economy, to operate in society like normal people.
Right. Well, with you know, our community, you often hear the police chief talk about we have a war on drugs, a war on crime, war on gangs. Anytime you talk about war, you have to throw in collateral damage.
Right.
And that's what they're preparing you for, is that you're in a war zone, so you're going to be a victim of, you're going to be collateral damage.
And it lets you treat people as if they're less than human.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. So I'm dying to hear, both of you talked about what happened when you saw the beatings and then the trial, which we're coming on the anniversary of the trial next month. Walk us through what it was like in the station and in your household and in your community when both of you heard that verdict, which I know all of us remember.
Right. When I heard the verdict, I was at home. I was watching it. I was on a day off. And I got a call, and I was told to come in. And I was like, I'm on my day off. They were like, everybody has to come in. Mm-hmm. So I live, as I mentioned before, I live in Southwest Division. I live in Leimert Park.
Okay.
So I was driving in, and everything was on fire. People were in the middle of the street looking into people's cars as they drove by. And it was just chaotic. So once I went into the police station, at that particular time, all the officers were there, but we didn't have enough equipment, enough cars, enough shotguns, tasers. So a lot of officers were just sitting there because we didn't have the resources to go out. And then we were told that the jails were full, so don't get involved in anything major. You know, it's a riot. How do you not get involved in anything major? So basically, for about 3 days, we just drove around and watched people loot. You know, for me, it was very troubling. You know, I had partners who would say, well, you know, they want to burn down the community. Let them do it. You know, but that was my community. You know, the stores that were being looted were my stores that I shopped. You know, the restaurants, the bank on 29th and Crenshaw. I used to work there, and people were breaking in there. So it was a very sad moment for me because I saw my neighborhood getting burnt down, and I couldn't do anything about it but watch.
Yeah.
So I was pretty much a spectator during the riots, and I was right in the middle of it. We went to Florence and Normandy. We were going back and forth all over the city, and basically we just watched. We were not prepared.
I wonder, is it true? Because I've heard this. I was like 7 when this happened, so my memory of it is kind of based upon, you know, the viewpoint of a 7-year-old. But I used to always hear how people said they weren't even allowed to leave to go to a, so if you were in South LA, you wanted to go to the IE to see your family, the police weren't even letting people leave, or they were making it difficult for people to leave. Was that a strategy to keep people contained?
Well, they weren't necessarily letting people leave. The other agencies were, like Beverly Hills and so forth, weren't letting people come in there into their community unless you prove that you lived there. You know, they have roadblocks all over, and they didn't want people looting in other areas, so they stopped people at their borders, and you had to show ID or proof why you were going there.
I was 14 then when the verdict came out, and I was in high school, and my high school, I was living in Inglewood, but my high school was in Hollywood. And I remember the, you know, school administrators getting the girls, it was an all-girls school, so getting the girls that lived like south of the 10 basically, and saying, y'all need to find a way to get home. Like, you need to go get home as soon as you can, because you know, you may not be able to get home if you don't leave now, you know? And I remember that, you know, and the days kind of like bleed together. Mm-hmm. I can't remember like, you know, everything chronologically, but I do remember my friend's mom coming to pick us up, and we were driving down Crenshaw and driving past the Crenshaw Mall. And so this probably was later on, but the National Guard was there. And I remember just being like, wow, like there's straight soldiers with rifles and assault weapons, you know, on the street in front of the mall. And they're here treating us like we're the enemy. It just felt very strange. And I guess, you know, I can't imagine what it's like to actually live in a, in a war-torn country. But that, I think that was like getting a taste of what it felt like to be occupied in a very real and visible way. I think we're occupied on a day-to-day anyway, but that just felt very different. And then I also remember like having to field questions at school, you know, later on. Like, why were people doing that? Like, you know, why, you know, to your point, like, you know, people want to burn down their own community. They just didn't understand why people were so upset. And it was so frustrating because I was like, I don't understand how you don't understand.
Right.
When this isn't about just one incident. This is, you know, this has been decades in the making. And it's like, you talk about it, you complain about it, you vent about it. And then, like I said earlier, there's a video now, so people are going to get it. You know what I'm saying? And then for people to see that and for that verdict to still come out, it just felt, yeah, people are upset and we have nothing left to do but to lash out and just to express your anger and frustration, because when you use your words or when you try to be civil about it, like, you're not being heard.
System. Yeah.
You know, so you just got it. You got to be heard in some way. And so it was just, just people who were not from the community, just not understanding. And I think there's still a lot of that now.
There is a good amount of it now. It's interesting to have been there for 92 and then to have been here for George Floyd. Mm. There's a ways in which you can see that there's some progress, and there are other ways which you look like, why are we even trying to get this right?
Yeah.
Like, what difference does it make? You know, Rodney King officers didn't know they were being videotaped. The guy in George Floyd, his partner say, hey, there's a camera there. He was looking up at the camera. Like, yeah, and what? You know, right. I'm still going to continue to do this. And then the public reaction. The public reaction this time was much better in lots of ways than it was last time. But it's still amazing the number of people who will stand up in a bold-faced way and make excuses for someone choking someone in broad daylight. Because they passed a bad $20 bill, maybe.
Right. Alleged crimes. And then, I mean, Siobhan, you talked about being a young person and being stopped while you're walking. And I'm glad, Marquise, also that you used the word children.
Right.
And it's not okay for any age range.
Right.
But when we're talking about Tamir Rice, this is a child.
Mm-hmm.
12
mm-hmm.
years old.
A child. We are meant to be protecting our children. And so for people to be making excuses around, you know, attacking and abusing our children is just really, it's really hard to understand why another person, even if they don't have that direct experience, cannot empathize with just the sheer, you know, wrong, evil of something like that.
Terror.
It's really frustrating.
And the terror of it. I mean, it gives trauma to a whole community.
It's the dehumanization of it. And I think, like, you went to USC, right? And I'm sure did you ever get those emails of the alerts, crime alerts?
ZPS.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I remember we used to get upset because they would be so vague. It would be like Latino male between 5'7 and 6'2 in a Dodger cap. Literally. These would literally be. That's actually one I specifically remember because they were often very broad. But it's almost like they're telling us, these are non-humans walking around here and you're in danger. Mm. And so when this time, when these situations come up, well, he wasn't really a human. He was a criminal. They start pulling up records and start trying to find pictures of young people holding up, you know, money phones in their Instagram picture and saying, look, he was a thug, you know. Mm-hmm. It becomes a point where we get dehumanized and the empathy is non-existent because it's almost like people think we deserve it. We must be the criminals. That's why it keeps happening. Look at our jails. Look at who gets arrested.
Sheriff Villanueva in the paper today said, I don't understand why all these woke people are protesting, because if you just follow the law, nothing will ever happen to
you. Wow. Because there's nothing wrong with the law, by the way.
Right. Well, there's that.
Because the law never changes to right. serve the people
right.
in power.
Right.
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 We've had the same laws since the
beginning of time. That person is the highest elected police officer in Los Angeles County. Today in the paper, he said that.
Wow.
And so it's, you know, so there's a way in which it continues. Brian, having spent time on the police department, you know, having written a book and, you know, been a bit of an activist, what are the things that you think do the most to move the police departments and police departments? Because I will say, I was just doing an interview yesterday and I said, look, policing is not like it was in 19, like when I was a teenager, it was very different than it is now. There's still lots of problems now. Like, I don't mean to say that it's anywhere near where it needs to be or should be or what we deserve, but it isn't like it was. You know, I was like, police officers call me sir. Police officers never call my dad sir. Mm. Never. And with a child sitting right next to him, they wouldn't address him as sir. So lots of things have changed. What are the things that you think are most effective in getting police departments to move?
Police departments react to lawsuits. I mean, it's plain and simple. If you can't sue them for a large amount of money, then change is not going to happen. They react to lawsuits, period. You know, I'm supportive of like Black Lives Matters and I like the way they're out there protesting. But the thing is, protests don't really affect police officers. When I was working during the riots in 92, I worked probably the first night I worked 18 hours, second night like 16 hours. Mm-hmm. I worked probably 3 weeks straight. And by the time I got my check, it was so large that I bought a jacuzzi. I paid off my car. And so I bought a big TV. So in office, and my partners were saying, man, these riots are great. We should have one every year.
Wow.
So we don't have to work off duty. You know, the money was great. So those things are very good visually, and it may help, it may help the politicians make decisions or make change. But as far as affecting police officers, it doesn't work. There are very few things that actually affect the mindset of police officers. And, you know, they're set on doing what they want to do, being in power, being in control. You know, I often talk about how as a police officer, I felt that I could pull over anyone. I could pull over Jesse Jackson with Al Sharpton in the car, and nothing would happen. You know, that's the kind of power that I felt because of my training and the support that I would have from the police department. So,
Judge Cunningham on UCLA's campus.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to hear your perspective from the inside because it just validates a lot of the things that, you know, that people think about the police department in terms of like, you know, the police department's always like, well, there's a few bad apples and like, if we can just get rid of them. But what you're talking about is this is the culture. And saying that we need training, you're like, no, we're getting trained. Like we're getting indoctrinated and the way that people are behaving is exactly the way that they've been trained to behave, which is why for me, the changes that the police commission just put through in terms of the limitations on the pretextual stops and holding police officers accountable, well, holding them responsible for holding themselves accountable is like, you've got to be kidding me. I'm supposed to now trust this bad actor to police himself. And that's why the Push LA Coalition has been calling. We want an end to pretextual stops.
Right.
Just end them. The police commission is saying itself, like this, I think the quote you shared was, you know, something like there's some pretty, you know, around racial disparities, around it not being productive in terms of actually fighting crime or stopping crime. Why are we continuing to do this? So if we remove all of those reasons, what I'm left with is that it is your process to harass people. And like you said, it's a numbers game. And we're not concerned about what that does in terms of trust or relationship or anything like that. It's, you know, we're going to basically, you know, knock some heads around and maybe we'll find, and that, man, that piece about the clipboard, and then we're going to go back and then make you match with something, that's just infuriating.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the challenges that I find in making public policy is, especially around policing, it's true of all issues, but policing has this element more than almost any other one. It's very hard for people to imagine something different. Hmm. Like, people who I had the expectation were very progressive, when we put forward the bill to end pretextual stops, they would say things like, well, what if someone's abducted a child? How are we going to catch them? Stunning to me that that's where you would go. You would say, okay, so that justifies all these things that we know happen. Right. First of all, when a child is abducted and they give you the warning, almost always the license plate number is a part of the warning.
Right.
So you don't need a pretextual stop. That's a textual stop. Mm-hmm. Like that's a stop because
we know it's you.
Yeah, we think you have this child and we stop you and you don't have the child. And, you know, and we don't think you can lead us to the child to go or other and reform minded. And I, you know, I want to note that I'm very committed to and do a lot of work with reform minded officers. And I try to make sure they get assigned to my district and they have the resources they need and the room they need and they're protected in their work. But even reform minded officers will say, well, we don't really look for burglars in LAPD or any big police department in the country. So someone breaks in your house and the police come and they dust for fingerprints or whatever. And, you know, Brian, you correct me if this is wrong. They say there's no officer that goes around matching prints. Like, that just doesn't happen. We pull people over. And if we happen to see that they have stuff in the back of their car, we try to connect it with a burglary. And sometimes, occasionally, we do. And so how will we ever catch burglars if we stop doing pretextual stops? So it's interesting the grip that it, you know, has on our heads. And I mean that for officers and non-officers. I mean, you know, one of the things Malina Abdullah, a Black Lives Matter, points out is, you know, the anti-police abuse anthem of our lifetime was written by the same person who stars in movies as a police officer. Ice Cube.
What's interesting, and I remember when I spoke to you, Brian, you actually said officers know all the words anti-police song, and they listen to them.
Oh, you ever
been white officers? They know NWA word
backwards
for word,
and forwards.
Everything.
Yeah. Oh, you've ever been with them backstage and see how the officers are with them? They're more fan people than I am. Yeah.
I never thought about it, but you're right.
Totally, they're the biggest
fans. I grew up listening to NWA, and I have one partner, and he would be saying stuff. I'm like, "Well, where'd you get that from?" He's like, "NWA. Didn't you know that?" I was like, "I listened to it, but maybe I'm not really listening to it." But yeah. They listen to it. They know it word for word.
Yeah,
word for word.
And it's,
we're listening,
you know,
too hard.
Yeah, it's Yeah, so it's one of those things that I think the imagination of organizers like BLM and Push LA, one of the most important roles they play is challenging the consciousness, not just of police officers, but of all of us. Like, we don't have to live this way.
Right. excuse me, since you brought up, since we're talking about BLM and I think you mentioned earlier, you know, the protests, and there's a lot of conversation around like this defund the police, right? And this tagline, and, you know, it makes a lot of people aren't into it, but I think, you know, defund the police is a start of a conversation. So to your point, Marquise, around, you know, people have trouble in imagining like what something else could be. Well, we've got some ideas, you know? And so,
right.
And I think the way that we can get to defunding the police is by taking away some of these responsibilities that they have, no business doing. And if we can make the case and say, we don't need police to be doing X, Y, and Z. So once they are no longer doing that, then they don't need that money that they had in their budget to be doing that. So for instance, with the pretextual stops, the example that keeps coming up is like, oh, okay, there's someone has a broken taillight. Now this could be dangerous, right? They could stop, they could cause an accident. So they need to be pulled over so that we could. So some of our Push LA members have said, well, okay, yes, that does sound like that could be a potentially dangerous situation, but can we have a civilian, just a, you know, someone who can pull over that person and say, hey, I noticed, you know, you have a mechanical, you know, problem with your car. Can I either fix it on the spot?
Exactly.
Let's pull over to this parking lot over there. I can fix it for you because I have a truck with all the equipment that you need. I can do that for you and send you on your way. And now the streets are safer. Or I can give you a voucher to a mechanic in your neighborhood. So let's bring some dollars to that small business, get your light fixed, and that problem is solved. So I think, you know, the defund conversation is ... to invest in other strategies. And so what are those other strategies that we need? And that's where the creativity and the innovation can come through, and members of the community can say, like, this is how I would want that situation to be handled. And it doesn't need to involve police officers.
You know, I think that's exactly right. Again, one of the things that I am coming to grips with as a lawmaker is we really live in a punishment society.
Exactly.
So our and that goes across the board. Like, somebody gets in trouble in the city council, kick them off the city council. Like, somebody has a broken taillight, fine them. Somebody has tags that are expired, which you pretty much is an offense limited to people that don't have money. Pretty much. I mean, there's some exceptions, but pretty much that's a financial infraction, or it's generated by your finances. We make it more expensive is what we try to do. Instead of saying like, hey, why don't you have your tags? Then that lets the person say, I can't afford it. And then we could say, how much can you afford? And then we can work it out so that you can pay. We have another bill before the city council to do just that. And the safety stops, as you point out, Leslie, I mean, the contradiction there is, if I have a broken taillight and it's dangerous, what good does it do for a police officer to give me a ticket and send me back onto the road?
Right.
Zero.
Right.
Zero.
This is revenue generation on the backs of poor people.
Totally, because if it was dangerous before the ticket, it's dangerous after the ticket. In fact, in a way, it's more dangerous. So the only remedy for that is to fix the taillight on the spot or make it so that they can get it fixed within very close proximity to the time that they're notified about it. So it's, you know, it's one of the things that I think we all have to continue to work on is getting people to understand we can be safe, we can have great communities without a lot of the problems that we've talked about today.
I think there's a lot of challenge, and to both of your point and Leslie's point, especially around crime and punishment, because especially even as Black people, I think that's how we've always existed. Mm. So it's very difficult for us to see it any other way. It's even how we parent, right? Mm. And how many times have we heard in our own communities, if I don't beat you, the police will. Yep. We really believe that's a tactic to prevent danger for our children. So we've almost bought into this crime and punishment mentality as a way to bring safety. One of the beautiful things about what you just said, Leslie, and the suggestions that you have made and has also been proposed by it into the council is that it's saying we want to look at things differently. We don't want to look at crime and punishment. We want to look at actual safety. What actually brings safety? You know what? A broken taillight can be unsafe. Here are some tools so we can make sure that this is fixed. It's important that your car is registered. Hey, we have a payment plan option, right? So how do we look at things preventively instead of looking at it as you must suffer because you made this infraction?
Well, one thing is that police, when they pull you over for a broken taillight, it's not because of safety issues. It's because they want to search your car.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's what it's about. They don't come to our neighborhoods to enforce traffic or to make us feel safe in traffic. It's specifically a reason to search a car. And one thing too I wanted to mention is that, you know, the police officers that you talk to who want to make change and so forth, you know, I'm just curious, do they live in Los Angeles? Because it makes a big difference.
A lot of them, even if they don't live there, they're raised there.
Yeah.
You know, like they were raised in the projects or they were raised in here and they, you know, had this idea. I don't know how they had the idea. They had the idea like, oh, I can go in and change everything. Mm-hmm. And then they get in there and they go,
I was there. That was me.
Yeah. And, you know, that was and they're like, oh, this is a lot bigger than I realized.
That was me. I was very idealistic. And that's why I became a police officer. But the thing is, staying in the community, I always had that fear. Mm-hmm. When I was a police officer, it was even worse because I had a gun. Mm-hmm. And I knew that if I got pulled over and someone saw my gun, a police officer saw my gun, they would shoot first mm-hmm. before they even asked me if I was a police officer. And just little things, being in the living in the community. I'm a track coach. I have a shovel in my trunk, plastic bags, some cord cuffs and stuff because I work on the track. Right. I know when I can put it, I'm going straight to the police station. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I have that fear all the time, mm-hmm. even now, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. you have that fear. So,
you know, that's so frustrating too when you're bringing up like the broader theme of violence is that it's just so frustrating that we as Black people are depicted as the ones that are violent when the foundation of this country is violence. Literally everything that it's the foundation of our country. So to be, you know, so we've learned that it's my husband and I were talking about disciplining our children and understanding that using violence against our children is also something that's been embedded in us and that we've been trained from times of slavery.
Yeah.
And working every day
to get your child.
Right.
That means use violence. Yeah.
Right. I mean, but it's a serious thing to be like working every day to think about how insidious the culture of violence and how embedded it is in our society and trying to remove the tentacles in every aspect of our lives.
No, I think that's right. You know, the exciting thing about now is the activism. And so, Brian, you've chosen to write books. I want to hear about your books, where we can get them. Can we get them on Amazon? Can we get them at Esalen, mm-hmm. in the community? Right. So tell us your titles and where we can get them.
The first book is called One Time, The Story of a South Central Los Angeles Police Officer. I wrote that when I was still on the job. I wrote most of my books when I was still on the job. And that deals with the culture of violence, how violence is accepted on the police department. And then my second book that I wrote is called Honor Without Integrity. And that deals with what a police officer's mindset, where you're wanting to do things the right way, make a difference, but you just circumvent everybody's civil rights and you do whatever you can and you justify it by saying, you know, I'm trying to help and make a difference. And then my third book is on domestic violence. It's called Hit Me Once, Hit Me Twice.
Wow.
And so you can get all of them on Amazon. I used to sell a lot at Esalen, but the books are kind of old now, and I don't think they carry them anymore. But you can definitely get them on Amazon.
And you can order them. Esalen.
Oh, yeah, you can order
them. Not to pitch too much for Esalen. Yeah. But Esalen and Malik Books, they'll order any book by Black Arthur for you. So you got that. And Leslie, the demands of the campaign, what you all see going forward. You know, how you all plan to make it a hot summer for all of us in Los Angeles.
So what Push LA is working on right now is actually related to a motion that you co-authored a few years ago. It's been quite a while.
Almost 3 years.
In the summer of 2020. And so this, connecting to stopping pretextual stops. So we're looking at what are alternatives to having armed police officers in traffic stops. And so there's been a community task force that's applications have been solicited. Consultants have been hired. So there should be a report coming out that talks about what some of these alternatives can be. And we want to make sure that there's community input for that. So that's kind of the next phase of that campaign that we're working on. And so we'll be, you know, looking for community members to let us know what they think.
Excellent. All right, this show is about South Los Angeles, and we're trying to document the history of our culture, our politics, and our aspirations at this time. So we ask folks some what we called lightning round questions about South LA that we ask you to answer without a beat. And so we will begin. I'll just throw out the question. Whoever wants to answer first does that, and then take a beat and the second person answer. Favorite song that represents South LA?
How to Survive in South Central.
For me, it was Ice Cube, It's a Good Day. That's answer one. And the second one is Montel Jordan, This Is How We Do It.
Yes.
Yeah, that's an only LA song.
That's so funny. I hate that song.
I don't like the song either. I can't stand the song.
Me either.
I cannot stand the song, but it's an LA song. Like, it's
just, because when it comes South Central on, I does it like right. Nobody right. Does.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's like Randy Newman's I Love LA. Home. Like, that's not a good record, but it's, you know, when they play it after the Lakers win, it's,
right.
It works.
I'm not sitting there with my hands folded.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not celebrating.
It works every time.
Okay, you guys aren't invited to the barbecue.
Right. Yeah, I know, right?
I am, because that's my song.
Yeah, no, you when you're DJing, that's one of those songs. This Is How We Do It is a song you resist playing. Mm-hmm. But every time you do, it works.
Move the crowd.
It just moves the crowd. All right. Change maker from South LA that inspires you?
My brother, Ken Bentley. He used to be the vice president of Nestle. Yeah, and he donated a lot of money to the community, started a lot of programs that are still going on. Right now, he has this organization called Advocates Golf Pro Tour.
Wow.
Where he's helping black golfers earn money to go on the PGA Tour.
Wow.
And he's from South LA, and, you know, so he's my role model.
Excellent.
I got two. I'm going to go with Issa Rae for really just depicting South LA and Inglewood as just not a nightmare, not a fantasy world, but just a place where we live and grow.
Yeah.
You know, and I really love seeing places that I recognize and then just, you know, being in the background. So I'm going to say Issa Rae and also Frederick Casey Price, who's the founder of Crenshaw Christian Center. That's the church I grew up in. And in particular, a series that he taught called Race, Religion, and Racism.
Oh, yeah, he went in.
Ooh, he went in. And like, I'm an ordained minister, and like that's kind of the root of my activism is in the black church. And so for him to say, you know, religion is a tool of white supremacy, mic drop.
Yeah.
So
Wow. Those are big ones. Favorite place or location to experience black culture in Los Angeles?
I'm going to say LA's Taste of Soul.
Nice.
I really enjoyed it in the beginning. I don't go now, but I used to go all the time.
Well, we haven't had it. I can't wait for us to redo it in real life.
And it's really grown, but I really like that, and I think it's a good experience for all
of us. Nice.
Yeah, I'm going to co-sign on the Taste of Soul, and then also I was reflecting on like what South LA culture means to me. And I would just say just Crenshaw Boulevard in general. Mm-hmm. Like it just, I just remember being a teenager, you know, on Sundays and just like the car culture is there. There's food, there's music, there's murals. There's Destination Crenshaw.
Boom.
So, you know, so I just think Crenshaw Boulevard is just South LA. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you all so much for sitting with us on MHD Off the Record.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. Thank you for sharing your stories, your hopes, and your dreams, and your frustrations, and thank you both for being a part of the struggle. I think, you know, the upshot of the story is Los Angeles continues to get better because people fight to make it better. Mm-hmm. And there is an ideal that we're a city of angels, but none of us pop out the wound as angels. And so we got to work together to create the angelic beloved community. And so you all are a big part of that, and you're on the front lines of that struggle. So thank you so much. And thank you for sitting with us for this hour.
Thank you.
I know you enjoyed that flashback episode with MHD, Leslie Cooper Johnson, and Brian Bentley. But we aren't finished yet. We still have our staffer sit down with CD8 Director of Constituent Services and Community Engagement, Brinley Garcia. She will speak with us about the impact of the 1992 civil unrest and how CD8 is supporting efforts to address many of the lingering effects. Before we get to that, here are a few community announcements. If you're between the ages of 16 and 30 and looking for an opportunity to kickstart your career this summer, listen up. Mayor Karen Bass and the Higher LA's Youth Program are hosting the Higher LA Day Job Fair. This is your chance to meet employers face-to-face and explore a variety of paid internship opportunities in public service. It's happening on Thursday, May 2nd, from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Los Angeles Southwest College in the Multipurpose Room located at 600 West Imperial Highway. These internships are a fantastic way to serve your community while gaining invaluable experience that could jumpstart your career in public service. Make sure you sign up in advance by visiting higherlayouth.com. Get ready to make a difference in your community and build a foundation for a great career. Calling all go-getters, innovators, and dreamers out there. Are you ready to turbocharge your entrepreneurial journey? Because the Vermont Sloss and Development Corporation is rolling out an action-packed month that you simply cannot afford to miss. Throughout the month of May, get set for a series of dynamic workshops and engaging webinars meticulously crafted to empower you, the trailblazing entrepreneur. Whether you're just starting out or looking to scale up, these events are your golden ticket. We're talking about mastering the maze of business credit, taking a deep dive into the nuts and bolts of entrepreneurship, learning how to become a government contractor, and so much more. Each session is packed with insights, strategies, and practical tips to take your business savvy to the next level. For the schedule and more information, visit www.vsedc.org or call 323-753-2335. Hey there, nature lovers. Have I got some exciting news for you. This Saturday, May 4th, the Los Angeles Public Library, together with the Los Angeles Audubon Society and Nature Nexus Institute, invites you to the Open Wetlands event at the Bayona Wetlands Ecological Reserve. This Saturday, May 4th, the Los Angeles Public Library, together with the LA Audubon Society and Nature Nexus Institute, invites you to the Open Wetlands event at the Bayona Wetlands Ecological Reserve. Experience the great outdoors and the rich tapestry of ecosystems that thrive in the Bayona wetlands. Whether you're a budding naturalist, a bird enthusiast, or just looking to spend some time in nature, this is the perfect opportunity for you. All you have to do is RSVP. Send an email to baldwinhillsliteracy@lapl.org for more information and to secure your spot. Spaces might be limited, so make sure you book your spot today. Now it's time to sit down with a staffer. Here, we talk with the CD8 staff member so you can learn a little bit more about the work we do to support our constituents, community organizations, small businesses, and other vital institutions in our district. For this segment, we sit down with Brinley Garcia, Director of Constituent Services and Community Engagement for Council President Pro Tempore Marquise Harris Dawson. In her role, she oversees the day-to-day operations and delivery of constituent services at the field office, while also spearheading the planning and execution of district-wide events with the field staff. Prior to her current position, Brinley contributed her skills at Community Coalition as an office manager, where she empowered everyday residents in South LA to catalyze progressive change within their communities. Welcome, Brinley Garcia.
You.
I'm so glad you're here.
Me too.
So, listeners don't know, but you and I go way back.
Ooh.
We both go way back from South Central Youth Empowerment through Action Days.
Yeah.
And so you are, I know you as a strong vocal activist since we were basically kids.
I was definitely vocal.
But the cool thing is both of us are now working in this office in Council District 8.
Yeah.
And I really am glad to work with someone as experienced as you. And one of my favorite things is the fact that we hire people from the community.
Yeah.
So you are someone who's from literally the 8th District, from the district. You're from South Central Los Angeles. And so
born and raised.
She says that with pride. Like, she tilted her head and smiled, make sure we were clear, born and raised. But you were also here, not to give your age away, or our age away, because we're the same age. You were also here in South Central as a small child during the 1992 civil unrest.
I was.
I would love for you to tell us a little bit about what it felt like for you being a child, growing up here during that time.
Yeah, definitely. I hold our age with pride, by the way.
good, because like I do too.
It gives us history, and I feel like our years give us wisdom, and some people are afraid of that number, but I really do hold the number with pride every time people tell me, or I tell someone how old I am. Like,
oh, good. It's good to know, so I don't feel so bad giving our age away.
You don't. don't at all. So I grew up in South LA. I went to all the schools, so people can know, like, pinpoint areas. I grew up off of Vermont in 92nd, Hoover in 92nd. Like, that little area was, like, my little, you know, when you're a kid, that's your universe.
You know?
Like, you even when you walk out to a main street like Manchester, you're like, whoa, this is where all the big cars are. But that's really where I grew up. That was my little universe. You know, Manchester Elementary, Bret Hart Middle School. I'm also a graduate from, you know, George Washington High School off of 108th and Normandy. So that was really my universe.
She's letting you know how authentic she really is. She about this. She's naming the elementary schools, giving you cross streets. Don't play about Vren. She's from here.
Yeah, like, you can give me a cross street and I'd be like, or someone will ask me a question of like, do you know about this park or this area? And I'm like, can you give me a cross street? Because then I know exactly what you're talking about. But yeah, so that was my universe. And as a child, you know, that's all you really know. Growing up in South LA, that's what I knew. As a teenager, that's what I knew. So that was my universe, just so I can paint a picture for you of what it was like growing up here. Algin Sutton was my park. That was a pool, 50 cent pool days, you know, back then.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about Algin Sutton in our next episode with Laura Garcia.
Oh, good.
Talking about our community safety partnership. Just because what she's saying is so significant. And I don't want you guys to miss out on why that's significant.
Yeah. So that was, you know, that's my little universe. That's where I grew up. So, you know, growing up in this area, my parents are immigrant parents from Central America. They came here looking for a better life for themselves. And so them moving to South LA was an opportunity for them. And so we moved here. I was about 3 years old, and this has been it, you know. And so during the 92 riots, I was in elementary school. And so I remember how I can describe it is, as the sun set, you start seeing just red skies everywhere. And so you're looking around as a small kid. I want to say I was probably like 8 or 9. And so you're a small kid looking up at the sky, and all you see is just red skies from the fires all around our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the biggest one that I remember was the one on Manchester and Vermont, because that was the swap meet and the Payless that we'd go to. You know, there's the Payless on the corner and the swap meet on, you know, in the middle. And it was a huge space. And that was like our shopping area. You know, as a kid, my mom would take me there, like, let's go buy socks, whatever, you know,
right.
Let's go buy shoes, the T-shirt,
school supplies.
Yeah, they had everything at that swap meet. And so I just remember us seeing the sky lit up red, helicopters everywhere. And it really didn't feel it was far, but not far, if that makes any sense. Like, it was just like, I know it's there and I can see the fire, but I still felt safe even because we were at home, you know? So I was just like, I don't feel in danger in my house, but I know that around me,
there's something going on.
Yeah.
Did you have any idea what was happening and why?
I remember seeing the news, like, my parents had the news on. I remember my dad climbing up to the roof just to kind of see how far the fires were, because you didn't have a sense of, is it in the neighborhood or is it out on the main streets? But, you know, once he got to the roof, he's like, oh, it's not closed. You can see the fires, but it's not closed. So I didn't really know as a child. You just kind of see this happening, but you don't really grasp the concept of what's really happening.
Right.
What does an uprise mean, you know?
Right. And it's interesting because I'm listening to you talk about it and you were in the thick of it. You're experiencing it. But what's actually happening politically, what's happening socially, you don't really have a grasp or concept of, and you can't really have that grasp or that concept. So I'm curious to know, now that you're older and you've had a lot of education around it, you know, you've had a lot of, you know, just learning about it. How would you say that impacted you as a child? And even your perspective now as an adult with this new information, with what you've learned, now that you see the political issues, the social issues that were part of it?
Yeah. You know, growing up, I always knew, you know, once I got to high school, I always knew we were at a disadvantage. Like it started with our schools, you know, our schools weren't the best quality. And so that definitely kind of put something in my mind, like, what can I do to make a change? Or what can I do to figure out why the school is the way it is, or our streets are the way they are? Like, I remember after the uprising, I remember walking. We used to have we're still there, actually, a liquor store at 92nd and Hoover. And for us, a kid that lives down the street, that would be the place where I would go buy candy, you know, and then just be like, I'm going to go to the liquor store to get some candy, to get some chips. And I remember after the 92 uprising, all you see was like a register outside thrown.
Right.
Trash everywhere. The burger joint was broken into. And so I always wonder, like, why did this happen? Like, what happened here that people felt the need to come out and destroy their own neighborhoods? Like, mm-hmm. what happened? But I never knew until I got older and really started looking into our systems.
I find what you just said extremely interesting, because you said, why would people destroy their own neighborhoods? And if you remember, that was the narrative, right? Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. what we would hear constantly. Growing up. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until, at least for me, I made it to places like the Community Coalition, mm-hmm. where that narrative wasn't that we were destroying our own neighborhoods. We were pointing out these are problematic businesses.
Correct.
In our communities.
Correct.
I find that, so I've always, what you're saying is so interesting to me, because it's like, wow, I relate to so much of what you're saying. And that conversation that we were having about ourselves. And I'm interested, I know this isn't really on our list of things, but I want to flip it a little bit because you brought it up. I'm curious to know from you, how was it hearing a new narrative about your community as you got more education? It wasn't like, hey, we're a bunch of barbarians here and we just destroy our own community, which is right. what the narrative was on mm-hmm. in the media. So how was that for you, switching that narrative?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't hard. I'll say that. And I think it's because I know that they're, you know, I come from immigrant parents, so I knew there were systems in place for them not to be able to get their, you know, documentation easily, you know, for them to become, you know, residents or citizens, like things like that. I knew there was always systems that held us back. Mm. And so growing up, I always grew up with, you know, I'm Latina or I'm Hispanic, whatever you want to call it. But I always grew up with Black folks around me. And they were like some of my best friends growing up. So I understood that narrative of how the systems in place have held communities of color down for so long. And I knew that, you know, through reading and through learning, like this is something that I want to change, and I want to be involved some way, shape, or form. And that started a Community Coalition.
So, you know, our district is where a lot of major incidents occurred during the uprising. One of the sites that was impacted was on the northeast corner of Manchester, Vermont. Everybody knows about what happened on Florence and Normandy.
Yes.
We know that's where the
epicenter.
The epicenter of it all. But there were other areas that were also impacted by that. And, you know, right across you from our constituency services, Constituent Services Center.
Yeah.
We have a site currently called Evermont. Can you talk a little bit about the site and the project and, you know, what's currently under construction there?
Yeah. So I'm sure everybody's seen it, you know, and I'm so excited for it. So thank you for
being
there.
Miss it if you ever.
True. You can't miss it. Manchester in Vermont. It's a big space. It's a big lot. And back when I was talking about it earlier, it was actually a swap meet when I was growing up. And for so long after the 1992 uprising, it just was an empty lot, burnt down. You know, they had demoed most of the buildings. I think it was like two or three buildings that were left. It became a little bit of a nuisance. And together with our office, when the council member came in, you know, that was something that we really wanted to look at, some of the empty lots that we have in the area and what's going on with them. What are the developers talking about? So when the L.A. County Supervisor at the time, Mark Willie Thomas, was interested in maybe making that site an eminent domain, and so taking that site back and making it now what it will be soon, you know, hopefully by 2025, I think, if not earlier.
Before you move forward, can you talk about what eminent domain is?
Yeah, so eminent domain, from my understanding, is when a government entity takes a property from a owner, usually land, and it's used for public building or public service, whether it's transportation, a school, anything that's public use.
Got it. So like I know sometimes they'll take a spot to build a fire station or public housing or something like that.
Yes. So at this lot currently, there will be a school. CDLA, and then there's also going to be a shopping center in the lower part of the new building, and there'll be upstairs will be all affordable housing.
Awesome.
So it's going to be amazing.
So I think that most people really have, you know, somewhat of an understanding from listening to you that, you know, there was a lot that happened during the civil unrest, and it had a huge impact to the point where we lost properties. And I won't say we lost properties. There was property. The property was still there, but the buildings weren't there. And the owners of some of these properties didn't build anything else. They just left it empty. Can you talk a little bit about why? Because you said this is one of the first things that happened when you got into office was looking at the empty lots. Can you talk about why having so many empty lots is problematic? Now, people in our district, we know why. Like this. So listeners who are like, girl, what you mean? We already know. Y'all know. We know because we're from here. But there are other listeners who might not be from here, who might be from a whole other state. And they have no idea why an empty lot at the rate that we've had them were so problematic.
Yeah. You know, in South LA, it just creates that blight, you know, of nothingness happening here. There's no investment in our communities. And so, you know, if we are trying to get more investment in, it's like, how do we give these different entities that might want to come in and take that empty lot or a different retail space? How do we ask them to come and come to our communities? You know, when there's blight or trash in these empty lots, you know, they're a nuisance. At the end of the day, they're a nuisance and they become a nuisance.
Right. And they're contributing nothing to the community. They're just there. It's an empty space where, like you said, it ends up being filled with trash because of wind blowing it and there's no one there to clean it up. There's high vegetation because there's no one cutting the grass in these empty lots. So absolutely, I think that's important people to understand. And I love how you also brought in the fact that it impacts our economic development. Because it's hard to get other businesses to want to come in when, like, well, when we were right next to this empty lot with a bunch of trash in
100%.
It.
100%. Yeah, like, that doesn't sound like that's where a business will thrive.
Exactly. Thank you for that. So how does it feel for you both as a South LA native and as a CDA staffer to see the development of Evermont? Because you're on both ends of that. You just talked about the impact the property had on you growing up, what occurred, you know, due to the civil unrest. And then now you're seeing something being built there. So what does that feel like for you personally?
For me personally, it gives me hope. Like there's hope for me to, you know, be able to, you know, my mom still lives on 92nd in Vermont. So it gives me hope for her to as she gets into her older age to be able to walk to Manchester and Vermont and say, I'm going to go to the grocery store, you know, or the store, whatever it becomes. Because I have those memories as a child, being able to walk to Manchester and Vermont from 92nd, you know, in Vermont and say, oh, I'm going to the store.
Right.
So something like that is amazing, where you don't have to jump in your car and go to the next door city, Inglewood, or, you know, northern of our district, where there is a little bit more, you know, shopping areas. So that's nice to actually have that and visualize that now. And as a Council District 8 staffer, I feel like, you know, it's a long time coming. We've been in office now for 8 years. And I think for the first part of the eight, which is the first 4 years, it felt like nothing was happening. And how, you know, the reason why I even became or wanted to be a part of this team was because I wanted to be able to create some kind of change and actually see it happen. And so being part of it now and being on the other end of that is very rewarding for me, you know? Like, I'm just like, wow, there's a new school, a shopping center, and, you know, a housing facility that's going to come up. And maybe I had a minimal, you know, like a pinch of work to do there compared to what my other colleagues did. But I can say that I was part of that team. And, you know, and I can say that forever. Nobody can take that away from me.
I love that. You know, I was going to ask also, why is it important that to the district that the Vermont corridor is not, I'm sorry, that we address empty lots and we address a lot of these issues that we have throughout our district. But why is it important to the district and to the Vermont corridor that projects like Evermont exist? But I feel like you answered that. I feel like you really make it clear, because you are a person who's from the community and you're also working on this side of it. I think you make it very clear that it's important for our residents to be able to have access to things like being able to go to the store, or just be able to have a space where you can still live in your community. Because right now, yes, I know community permanence is a big part of one of our goals here at the office. And we want to make sure that we can have affordable housing for the people who are from here and live here. It's part of our permanent, yes, supportive housing work. So I think you've answered that. But if you want to add anything else to that, feel free.
No, I think you're right. Like, you hit that on the money. And I feel like that's really what it is. We want to create a space, create a city, create a new South LA for us. And with us in mind, you know, we are the people that live here and we want to continue to be those people that live here. Yeah.
Love it. Okay, girl. Well, we're going to wrap this up. And before we go, I would love for you to tell us a little bit about your role as Director of Constituent Services and Community Engagement. It's a nice long title that lets you know how important she is to us. So tell us a little bit about your role and what that means and what you do.
Yeah. So, I mean, just that, Director of Constituent Services, it kind of tells you what it is. You know, I am trying to make sure that our constituents are being heard, and any issues that come across, we're able to address them as much as we can as a city entity. You know, most of those are city services. So making sure that, you know, we get what we always need, our basic city services that the city should be able to provide. That's one of the things that I try to make sure that we do in our office and encourage all our team members to do. The last bit of my title, which is the community engagement work, is that engaging our constituents, engaging our community, like, what, you know, in other areas, in more affluent areas in the city, we don't need to create spaces to have, you know, a toy drive like our Winter Wonderland or our Movies at the Park nights, because other entities do it. You know, there's, right, other different community-based groups or not community-based groups that
they just private entities.
Yeah, private entities that just say, I'm going to create such and such space. For us in South LA, it's a little bit harder. So we take on that role as, you know, the council member always wanted to make sure that our community is engaged. And in that, with that in mind, we keep that, you know, whether it's at our parks, whether it's, you know, when we do Winter Wonderland, we do it at Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Mall. So just having those different community open spaces with events that can get our community engaged, whether it's a resource fair, different things.
Town halls,
right. Exactly.
And one of the things that I always talk about this, when I've talked about this with many of the staffers that have come on here, is how, even when I came in, one of the things that impressed me the most is how engaged we are with the community. And when I say engaged, I mean the residents gonna tell you what they want, how they want it, and we make sure that they're heard. Like, yes. We actually have meetings saying, okay, what do you want this building to look like?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Because we don't want to just come in and just say, this is what we want. No, we represent the community. Mm-hmm. And I think you do a great job at that. And just to kind of give people a little bit of an understanding of what makes you so great for this job, I would love for you to talk about how growing up in South LA informs your current role and informs your work now in your current role.
It informs my role every day, you know, because I could be planning a movie at a park and they're like, but you know, that's not the park that we want to have it at. Whether it's someone that I speak to at the park, our park director or other constituents, we should have it at this park because this one has, you know, more capacity or whatever the case might be.
More parking.
Yeah, they're just basic things like that. It informs me every day. And I feel like because I know the community so well, like I know my cross streets, I know, you know, take Normandy instead of Western if you're going to go to Adams, you know, just like take this side street that, you know, I just know the area so well that it benefits me because I can always be like, this doesn't work or that doesn't work. This event will work here. That doesn't work there. This community town hall works here, doesn't work there. Let's use this school. Let's use this, you know, facility, whatever the case might be. So it informs my work a lot every day. And as far as constituent work goes, you know, when somebody calls me and says my sidewalk is broken on this street, I was like, I know exactly what you're talking about because I've driven by there every other day, you know. Mm-hmm. So it makes me, I feel like anytime I talk to someone, obviously they want to be heard, but it also makes them understand me in the sense that no one else can probably understand. Like they're like, oh, she's, when I tell them the cross streets and I tell them the avenue, whatever the case might be, they'll be like, oh, she knows what she's talking about.
Right. And they trust you more.
And they trust, 100%. Absolutely. 100%. They're always like, oh, you know what I'm talking about.
One of my favorite things that you do, and I think it really only comes from being from here, is that when, you know, any of us, me doing like digital engagement and then some of the other staff, when they're getting fussed at by residents about something in particular, the funny thing is, it's like, yeah, we can't necessarily fix the situation. It's the best we can do and have some empathy and understanding for the constituent. Because, yeah, of course, yes, they're pissed off. Yes. Like they should be.
Yes.
And like, yes. And I love that you're always able to frame that like, yeah, well, people are going to be mad because this is what we experience in this community all the time.
Yeah.
So it also informs us to be able to make sure that we're empathetic and we're patient with our constituents, because we have to come from a place of understanding of, look, you know, if you've been complaining about this for the past 20 years and, you know, we've been, and while our office is doing everything we can to make it happen, we're working, we're pushing, we're meeting with Bureau of Street Lighting, we're meeting with Public Works, we're having these conversations, which is why I told you guys in the last episode, make sure you do those 311 reports. That helps us.
Yes.
But you keep us, you know, grounded in understanding, like, no, these residents and constituents have every valid reason to be upset. And we are here to make sure that we do everything we can to address those needs.
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly what it is. I mean, and yeah, like you said, that empathy, because I'm like, yes, I live here. I live on 92nd Vermont. I know exactly what you're talking about. I know what corner you're talking about. It definitely changes the conversation. And you know, they understand that we're here to help them, not to tell them what we can't do, but to actually listen and help in where we can.
Awesome. Yeah. So if you're a constituent and you're trying to, you have questions about city services, if you have any questions around, even if you're an organization in our community and you want to learn how to get more engaged with our projects and get more engaged with our events, just give us a call on our Constituency Services Center. Do you have that number offhand?
I do. It's 213-485-7616.
All right. There you go. The information will also be in the show notes. Thank you so much, Vernaline.
Thank you, Siobhan. It was good to chat again.
I know, it's like, honestly, trying to get time with her to chat, I had to book her on this podcast. I haven't had like a just sit down with Vernaline in so long, and I've been working here for like 2 years now.
This
so
is great.
So next time I'm gonna make sure I just book time for the podcast. Thank you for listening to MHD Off the Record. I'm your producer, Siobhan Taylor. For more information, please visit mhdcd8.com and follow MHDCD8 on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Don't forget to rate us 5 stars, subscribe, and share with a friend.